Welcome to the Everyone Gets a Trophy podcast. I am joined by none other than the enthusiastic, the bigger-than-life personality of Ian Boyd, made even bigger by the fact that he's sitting here folding laundry. He was kind enough to join me and share his insights. Ian, what's going on, my man?
When you asked if I could pod tonight, I was like, you know what? I got to do something because I'm going to be folding laundry for like 2 hours. So.
And what did I say to you in response?
You said, I asked if I could do laundry while we did the podcast. And you said, that'd be great because you need more of a woman's perspective on this podcast.
That's right. I'm very inclusive.
I read that text aloud to my wife.
Oh no. Does she now hate me?
No, she enjoyed it.
Good. See? That's my kind of broad. She got a sense of humor. Cool. My compliments to the wife and to your family. I'm hoping your son works his way down at some point and joins the pod as he likes to do. All right, man. We got some stuff to talk about. So I'm going to give you the choice. Actually, no, I'm not going to give you the choice. I want to talk about Ryan Wingo, because Texas just got a commitment from the St. Louis, Missouri wide receiver. He's a five-star, more than the star rating, Ian. He's a guy that when we kind of turn on the huddle, I think you and I both had similar reactions, unless I'm assuming something about you. What do you think about Mr. Wingo?
I'm just refreshing myself. I watched him and I thought like Justin Blackmon. Like he's bigger and faster than everyone else on the field.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a novice to huddle, or if you're just bad at guessing guys' sizes, you'd think he was like 6'3", 220 or something, right? From the way he looks on a high school football field. But at the same time, you can tell that he moves at a different speed than everyone else. And he's in what? St. Louis area?
Yeah.
So it's not like, that's not quite South Dallas, but it's not, you know, South Austin, right? In terms of talent level and competition.
Yeah, he's not tearing up rural Nebraska. Yeah. And I think the thing that struck me is he is the new receiver type, the new archetype, which is, so we'd always associated big receiver. What we actually meant by that was tall receiver. So people will say Adonai Mitchell, big receiver, tall receiver. He's not very strong. He's not a yak guy, yards after contact. He is a ball winner, but he's not a guy that you necessarily can throw every route to. He's not going to be necessarily dynamic in every situation. But then there's this new breed of receiver. And I'm talking about the AJ Browns for the Philadelphia Eagles. I'm talking about the Debo Samuels for the San Francisco 49ers. They're big receivers, Ian, but they're not tall necessarily. They're 6 feet, 6'1", and they're built like a brick shit house, and they can fly, and they have ball skills, not just with the ball in the air, but after they catch the ball, they can face up on defensive backs, and they're basically like a running back. I see Wingo in that mold, and I find that really exciting because I don't think we've had that guy with that size speed combo at Texas in that particular way. Does that make sense? Or can you think of another guy who was like that?
Yeah, you'll probably find a way to quibble with this.
All right, bring it.
Roy Williams.
Yeah, but
he was
so
tall
yes,
too.
But he was a traditional outside receiver, was he not?
Yeah, well, he was like 6'3", right?
Oh, yeah, 6'3", 215.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know. He looked bigger than that at times. It helped that they used to play with those enormous shoulder pads, so everybody looked kind of bigger.
Yeah, and guys also wore their thigh pads and their knee pads instead of like capri pants like they do now.
Duvernay is not quite. He's short. He's Paul's indicating a lack of height. with his hand. I mean, Duvernay was built like a running back, right? He was like,
but he was muscled up, to your point. He was like 205, right?
I think he was even bigger. I think he was.
Okay. So Duvernay would be the best parallel of the type of receiver I'm describing.
Yeah.
So Roy Williams, I've seen that type of receiver many times, and Roy Williams was dynamic with the ball in his hands. He was great over the top. Second best receiver in Texas history, in my opinion.
Duvernay is not a great comp either, though, because Duvernay is like, so like, I feel like what you're getting at is, so guys like Duvernay used to just play running back.
Yeah.
No question. Now sometimes they play receiver. Wingo would not have played running back in very many eras. I mean, there have been running backs like that, like Dickerson, right, was kind of like that, only maybe a little lankier. But I don't think they played offense in the past. You know, like these guys that are like, I don't know, really powerful, athletic, but a little bigger and a little bit taller than your typical running back.
Yeah, the category of receiver I have for him, it's a subset of the big receiver, and I call them horsepower receivers. And they're different from a glider or an acrobatic guy or even a big-bodied guy who's 6'5", 230, right? These are guys that generate RPMs, and like there's a real fear that if that guy catches the ball on a slant, he not only might not just outrun everybody, he might also truck your safety on the way. And I kind of see some of that in Wingo. So, you know, maybe I'm projecting because I want AJ Brown on our football team. I want Deebo Samuel on our football team, but I think he's more cut from that mold. I mean, he's got to be over 200 pounds right now, and he's a senior in high school. I got to think he's going to play at Texas at 215 plus.
How tall was that? Who's that guy with the Baltimore Ravens that was almost like the prototype of this? He was like, oh man, he was like 220. Anquan Boldin.
Oh yeah.
He wasn't fast, so it's not exactly the same.
So Anquan, you nailed it on the toughness and the running ability part. He was a legit 4.7 40 guy. Wingo is a 10.6 100 meters guy, verified, right?
Yeah.
He's fast. And to your point, people will say, you know, LOL, look at the competition. Well, that's what people said about Bijan Robinson in Arizona, right? And when you're getting past your LOL's competition, notice just how he's moving in space. It doesn't really matter that there's small guys falling on the ground around him, right?
Yeah.
And I kind of feel that way watching Wingo. He's kind of a different dude, and it doesn't take many clips to see the difference. So, you know, we don't know how he'll develop. We don't know how he'll project, but I'm pretty excited because I think he's a type of receiver that's very complementary to the skilled receivers that Sark has been getting, like Jonte Cook, DeAndre Moore, even Freddie Dubose, right? These are kind of skilled, quick guys. But they're not, I don't think they're terrifying to a secondary the way a Ryan Wingo kind of guy is.
You know who else is like this, actually?
Sure.
Except for, so Jordan Whittington is actually this as well, but Whittington doesn't have the same ball skills, basically. It's like Whittington with ball skills is this guy.
I'm glad you brought that up. So Whittington is perceived by the casual Texas fan as like a flawless, sure-handed receiver who can sort of do everything and you know, will catch the ball. And if you notice, he struggles to run vertical routes and catch the ball, right? We don't even employ him that way because he's not good at it. And also he drops some balls, you know, to be honest. Obviously, we all love Jordan Whittington, but also I think there's a gear missing with respect, you know, Whittington pre-injury might have been a good comp because I think he lost some explosiveness through his different hernias and all that kind of stuff.
He should really have been a safety.
You love that. You always love the idea of Whittington at safety. I was always open to it, but
I mean, he could probably go to the NFL and still figure it out and be a safety, I think.
I guess the problem with the fragility and injury aspects was, do you want a guy tackling?
Better to be the hammer than the nail, though.
Yeah, well, Quinn Ewers dropped the hammer on David Ogwebegu. now we're gonna be starting Malik Murphy for a couple of weeks, I should say.
He looked like he dropped the hammer and
on his foot.
Yeah. I don't think that went quite like he planned.
In his mind.
That was absolutely a mullet Quinn play. Like, I know my right shoulder's hurt, but I'll just lead with my left.
I will file that next to the I'm getting hit by a blitzer, so I'll leap in the air that it will be less of an impact. But hey, part of the learning process of being a quarterback, you got to learn to protect yourself. Texas gets to learn to protect itself against BYU. Are you concerned about the Mormons storming into Austin? 5-2, Ian. They're 5-2.
Yeah. Not really. You notice that Vegas is not too worried about the action on this. They like opened it at like Texas minus 20 or something.
Yeah, it's down to 17.5. We may see an interesting move on game day. I don't know how much of that is casual knowledge, though, or what the books know about Quinn. And, you know, so that there was an adjustment there. Also, I think Vegas has access to advanced analytics, and they also have a broader perspective, let's say. And I think that's influenced by looking at BYU's actual body of work. So I was mentioning they're 5-2. Their total opponent record is 18-34. They faced one team with the winning record. That's Kansas, and they lost on the road by 11. Their marquee victory, Ian, at the time looked pretty good. Arkansas, right?
Yep.
But the Pigs are 2-6. They haven't won an SEC game, and they just fired their offensive coordinator, and they're probably going to fire Sam Pittman. So, you know, that's kind of been put in context. They also have a win over an FCS team, Southern Utah, a team I did not know existed. That's a 2-5 FCS team. They also beat Sam Houston, who are currently 0-7, and they have the worst offense in FBS. So
is that Sam Houston State or is it a different school?
Sam Houston State.
Okay.
I think they like to go by Sam Houston. It's kind of like when Texas A&M people try to say they're the Texas Aggies.
Okay.
Instead of the A&M.
Isn't Sam Houston? I thought Sam Houston State, did they just move up from FCS?
Yeah, they moved up to FBS.
Why did they do that?
I don't know. I think they won the national title, 2 years ago in FCS? Yeah.
I swear their head coach had a comment where he was like, getting excited to play and win the Poinsettia Bowl versus winning a national championship in the FCS. I just can't get excited about the Poinsettia Bowl.
Wow.
I like being here. I swear it was the same Houston State coach that said that.
I think it's – look, it's a natural progression. If you're a lower academic level, smaller college, you want to try to create athletic programs to draw students, right? And you want to try to create some sort of buzz around your school, right? So you've got Jacksonville State with Rich Rod, right? You've got all these different schools trying to elevate, but there's the, you know, there's differing models of, hey, why don't you be Montana State or Montana and have a great fun school experience, and you're kind of a big fish in a small pond. So yeah, I don't know why they did that.
Some administrator calculated that it was in their interest. I don't know.
There's probably no doubt. I mean, there's probably a lower level Flutie effect of just playing major college football, right? Even if you're getting beat. So let's talk about BYU, because I think they're a little bit interesting in that their defense is more than the sum of its parts, and their offense is less than the sum of its parts.
So by that, do you mean like, because I'm interpreting that the offense actually has probably, I don't know, at least maybe two guys that could play on an NFL team someday. But they
I know one of them. Who's the other? Who Kingsley Sumatea? Who's the other one?
Presumably one of their receivers will end up being on a roster and then suddenly putting up 100-yard games in Sean McVay's offense.
Yeah, Puna, like Puka Nakua. Isaac Rex, the tight end, looks to me like an NFL guy.
Okay, Rex. Yeah, Sumatea is, however you say that. I listened to it on a pronunciation guide on their roster like five times today.
And it still didn't help. Yeah.
I think it was like Sumatea. Sumatea.
Kingsley Sumatea.
It sounded like something from the movie Moana.
Well, it is.
It is, right, but I can't quite get it.
Yeah, so you don't think Keaton Slovis is going to be an NFL starter?
It doesn't look like it.
Doesn't look like that's going to happen for them. The reason I say they're kind of less than the sum of their parts is because their offense is bad. It's not respectable. It's bad. So from a simple counting stats perspective, they're averaging only 4.9 yards per play, 300 yards per game of offense.
Jeez.
Like these are Tyrone Swoops, Charlie Strong era type offensive stats, right?
Yeah.
The more sophisticated advanced stats, 109th on early down success, meaning first and second down, 120th on third down success. Those two numbers are probably interrelated, right? If you don't do well on first and second, you're setting yourself up to do pretty poorly on third. But there are teams that are very explosive who don't do necessarily well on early downs, but they convert third and long all the time. Texas occasionally being one of them. So that's not good. Why do you think this is? They can't run the ball. Yeah. And
well, you're gonna steal my answer before I can offer it.
Okay, sorry. Why do you think that is, Ian?
They can't run the ball and they're not great in pass protection to make up for it. So they can't really control the point of attack in any realm of football. But they have a decent quarterback and dangerous receivers, and they execute good plays now and then in the passing game. And so they move the ball and they make good plays now and again, but on a down-to-down basis, they're like behind the eight ball all the time.
Yeah, I think that's mostly right. The one thing I might quibble a little is they can't hit explosive plays.
Hmm.
And they also, given the fact that they're a short to intermediate type of passing offense, because they can't run the ball, Slovis is only completing 56% of his passes.
Oh, right.
So within that range, they should be at 65% plus accuracy. And they're not. And so, and they also play a lot from empty sets. They'll play four wide. You'll notice actually one of the few things they do okay or adeptly is in the red zone, they actually go empty set five wide. And they run a bunch of pick plays and they let Slovis sit back there and throw it in the back of the end zone to whoever pops open. So that is something to be aware of for Texas, but also they don't go to the red zone very often.
It'd be alarming if we thought that they were going to get there very often against Texas.
Well, so that's the other part. Sometimes Pete Kwiatkowski likes to minimize explosive plays by alignment and by the disposition of the defense. I think their inability to hit explosive plays against a wide range of teams, this has been proven, right? Less talented than Texas on defense. Seems to me like you want to rush them with four, keep some, and prevent them from making these easy short to intermediate throws. And by the way, I don't think that it means you like press man or, you know, all out blitz or anything like that. I just think you rush four and you cover them. And I think you're going to end up getting coverage sacks and forcing turnovers and incompletions.
I mean, this is your crusade every week.
I mean, not always. Sometimes I think it's appropriate to blitz, and I think it's appropriate to blitz in the right spots, not from the edge, 19 feet from the quarterback. I think actually more than 19 feet, but I just think that we're better against this kind of team when you take away any ability for them to gain any early confidence. I mean, so their best comparison, they're more talented, obviously, and certainly more physically mature. The best comp is Rice. And you'll notice Pete Kwiatkowski came out with a very aggressive coverage game plan against Rice. They did not concede anything. And I think you saw the results of that.
Maybe he'll think similarly, because Rice had JT Daniels, right?
Similar quarterback, literally similar quarterback on many levels.
So maybe PK looks at guys like that and he says, these guys know how to find easy candy, so I'm not going to give it to them.
And they're statues, so we don't have to like plant spies or, you know, play zone and just stand and watch, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
I don't think, frankly, I mean, I'll just come out and say, I don't think we teach zone very well. And I'm not sure if that's a PK thing or if that's a secondary coach thing.
Well, it's the scheme comes from PK, theoretically.
Yep.
The teaching and implementation is absolutely the DB coaches. I've noticed, I was talking with Rod about this for the most recent football theory. They routinely are bad at blitz coverage the last 2 years. I don't know if their every down coverage is so much of a problem, like when they're just playing their base quarters coverages on second and 10 or whatever. But when they play whatever blitz coverage they like in a given year, to allow them to bring five defenders or whatever, it's routinely not good and just error prone. And I don't know, you could say that might reflect on PK, because at Washington, his preference was always to just bring four, even on the blitz. If he was blitzing, he was still only going to bring four and he was going to drop somebody out. And there's always these holes in their coverages the last 2 years, and boy, do they get found consistently.
Yeah, the nature abhors a vacuum, and so do offenses facing Texas. If they see a little void, they go fill it with a receiver in the ball. And obviously, it was pretty frustrating against Houston running mesh. Hey, why do we call crossing routes mesh now? Or is it just our need to create new terminology for old concepts to make it sound cool?
This is slander against the Pirate. Rest in peace.
I never will slander the Pirate.
Yeah, so you should just shut your dirty Pirate mouth.
All right, I'll shut my Pirate mouth. I still find that amusing. It's like when you are trying to like call something just average, and like a loser who calls something mid or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Those people. Aren't they annoying?
So annoying.
They're the worst.
I mean, there's a couple of particular mesh plays that are like super popular across college football right now. The mesh rail one with the running back running a wheel.
Uh-huh. Is
one of the more ubiquitous plays in football.
Hey, did you see the Alex Grinch comments, by the way, about that?
No.
Oh God, it was funny. All right. So I don't even need to get into the bizarre stuff that's going on at USC. Lincoln Riley is sick and for 2 days straight, and they've named Cliff Kingsbury an assistant so he can only go out and coach practice. And, you know, Lincoln Riley throws a tantrum and won't allow his players to be interviewed after the game. He doesn't do his radio show, all this stuff, right? While that's going on, they go to Alex Grinch. And of course, if you guys keep up with college football, Utah has been just scrapping together ways to win every week. It's pretty cool. But they have this safety, Polynesian guy, of course, Utah, who's really explosive with the ball in his hands. I mean, amazing. And last week, he played against Cal and had a huge game, both as a pass catcher and as a runner. And then he tore up USC, particularly as a pass catcher. And he tore him up on that little combo mesh wheel route. And he was the wheel. So they asked Alex Grinch about it, and they said, And he says, yeah, they've never, you know, shown that on film. That was a surprise to us. The week before against Cal, that guy had caught three balls on that route and he'd scored a touchdown, a long touchdown.
Well,
then they ask Alex Grinch about Bryson Barnes, the Utah quarterback, the former pig farmer. And they said, hey, he seemed to also kind of hurt the defense with some opportunistic runs. And Grinch said, yeah, you know, Utah has not shown quarterback run game.
Oh my God.
Like every Utah quarterback, to include Cam Rising, they've got quarterback run game. Like that's part of their DNA. And this guy, Bryson Barnes, against Cal, had rushed for like 60 yards the week before. So not only may Alex Grinch be completely losing the plot in terms of recruiting personnel and his schemes and his little, you know, trying to create slants on every single possession, he may not be watching film, Ian.
Well, so at Oklahoma, in that last year at Oklahoma, all of a sudden their linebackers never understood, like, if the running back leaves the box and goes out to the flat, you got to cover that guy. Like, yeah, someone has to cover him. And if it's not you, then that means that you got to pick something else up. And teams would just march down the field on them on like slant flat combos and stuff. And after the games, he would be so angry. And he's like, believe me, we have someone account for the running back in coverage. We're just not doing it. And it was basically like these stupid idiots won't do what I tell them to do.
Huh.
Is what it sounded like. And at USC now, he's just coming up with other excuses. I think my big theory of the case at USC is that they got there after Todd Orlando. They realized that none of their players knew how to play football on defense.
Right.
And so he just fell really hard into your call matching deal. And none of them know what they're doing. He just tells them where to go, where to run on the field, and he hopes that it works.
It's play calling Battleship. Yeah. I-9. Oh, there's nothing there? Okay, well, I guess that's a miss. They gained 20 yards. But every now and then, you hit a ship on E3, Ian, and it's all worth it. And it's 2nd and 18. Now, they convert that, but
they
still.
They convert it, yeah.
Still, you inflicted that negative play and you created havoc.
Yeah. The numbers say that if you inflict havoc, you're going to play great defense.
That's right. You're dominating. All right. Well, a little bit of a USC Grinch aside there. I thought you might enjoy that. But
real quick. There's a rumor that he's been fired and Riley just doesn't want to face the media about it.
Because he was trying to interview with NFL jobs?
I don't know. I don't know if I believe that.
I don't believe that, I don't think.
He makes $11 million a year at USC.
Yeah, and also USC would make a statement had they fired their coach.
No. they fired Grinch.
Oh, they fired Grinch and he's still at practice every day?
Oh, he's still at practice every
yeah,
day?
Yeah,
yeah. That rumor's probably not true then.
Okay, yeah. I'm going to say that's not. I love that he does the Costanza. Like, we fired you. He's like, no.
They should. Riley should. I hope where he is, for his sake, is at Ruffin McNeil's house, begging him to come back and do one more year.
And just do the experience DC, nothing fancy. Let's all just learn how to play cover two.
Yeah, I think the world of McNeil. I think that guy was like, his whole thing was like, teach good base defense and then attack tendencies out of your base defense.
Right.
And if you notice that Texas tends to audible to a certain protection in a certain situation that doesn't account well for a cornerback blitz, then tell your guys to just bring that cornerback blitz.
Yeah.
Live in the moment without your DC having to tell you. And maybe you'll get a safety in the Big 12 championship.
Yep. Yep. That's true. That was a characteristic of old Ruffin. That's classic football, right? You teach basic stuff, you teach the position, and then you have a couple of wrinkles based on their personnel or their preferences. So oh, Texas has only one receiver that they feed the ball. All right, well, we're going to run our base stuff, but we're also going to double him. And that's it. That's our defense. Let's go execute it.
That was the end of Tom Herman's time at Texas, in my opinion, is he got just pantsed in the 2018 Big 12 championship game. And it was just kind of all downhill from there.
Yeah, Tom's got some other stuff going on, but that could be the on-field X's and O's part, I'm sure.
Well, it was like the last there was no coming back from that. Probably the LSU game was a bigger deal, but I don't know. What else do you want to talk about?
You want to talk? Yeah, we did enough diversions here. Well, there is one thing I want to talk about, and that is we have a BYU defense that I'm hesitant to call good, but they do some good things, and they're probably they are the reason that BYU is 5-2. And what I'm talking about is they have a pretty impressive ability to force turnovers. They're coached by Jay Hill, who was the former head coach at Weber State. He took the DC position after Kalani Sitake fired his defensive coordinator last year, and he's improved them. And what they've managed to do is they forced over 2 turnovers per game. They have 11 interceptions in 7 games. 2 guys are combining for 7. And that's it. You know, they're not shutting people down. They're not particularly good against the run. TCU threw for 439 yards against them. But what they're able to do is disguise coverages, and they teach their corners to basically attack out of that disguise. They're not just accepting of certain routes that are predetermined reads. So I think that might be relevant for Texas starting a new quarterback with Malik Murphy. What do you think the best way to combat that is, other than lining up and running the ball over their ass?
Well, I mean, my guess is that they're actually going to dare Texas to throw the ball to beat them.
You think they'll stack the box?
Well, they made disguise. So maybe they show coverage and then just load the box late.
Or they just have safety sprinting towards the line of scrimmage after the initial read.
Or maybe they want Texas to try to throw it. So they show a loaded box and then they
back off.
Every once in a while back off into coverage, and other times just stay home. And so that's what I would do, right? I am if I'm BYU, I'm not at all sure that Malik Murphy can beat me.
Yeah, so here's the weakness of their scheme, personnel-wise. They've got a couple of good corners who can be a little gambly, but they get some results. Their safeties are not athletic. And they're fearful of them getting exposed. They also lost Ben Bywater. He was their best linebacker. He was also their best coverage linebacker. And so they don't get great coverage fits between their linebackers and their safeties in the middle of the field. So I think there's some opportunity for Texas there off of pretty straightforward play action, almost single reads to Sanders, to Worthy, if we want to line him up in the slot, to Jonathan Brooks, just coming out of the backfield. I think that is an interesting opportunity for Texas. Also, I would say if you're worried about disguise, spread the field.
The only thing is that some of Texas's go-tos are like the Big 12 package.
Yeah.
Get Malik Ogbo out there, get extra beef and force him to declare. But if the other team can load the box and they don't just get destroyed by you throwing over the top to Worthy and Mitchell, then you are in a world of hurt.
Yeah, I don't know though. So I don't necessarily concede the running game just because you bring an extra man down in the box.
Yeah, well, BYU is the sort of team that might be able to execute that. Like if Houston did that, I don't know how much it would help them. But BYU, it might. Especially with like Texas has been so bad this year at like having Jonathan Brooks' log will go like 0 yards, 3 yards, 1 yard, 25 yards, you know?
Yeah. It's what you don't want in your running game.
This offensive line is really like, I think they were selected and they're at their best at allowing for set piece offense that can deal major damage to a defense. But on a down to down basis, they have not been dominant any year since Sark and Flood arrived.
I agree 100%.
I don't know if that's, I mean, some of that is scheme because they orient towards being really good at set piece offense. You wonder if maybe that will change when all these young guys are older, but I'm not actually sure if it will. They may just be even that much better at set piece offense.
Yeah, you know, I think that's one thing that maybe people have a misunderstanding of. They assume because of the large humans thing that Texas will get better at run blocking based out of size.
Uh-huh.
But big guys are actually, I mean, there's a reason Mike Leach had gigantic offensive linemen for pass protection.
Yeah.
Particularly inside. And so I don't know that that's the case. And some of the most effective pure run blockers in college football, you know, it's the 6'2" guard who's 3'10" and has a lot of quickness and just power out of their stance. Yeah.
That was Casey Studdard.
Yeah. I mean, and before him, a guy at Texas named Dan Neal, who was just fantastic, you know, 290-pound guard, probably 6'1". I knew Dan. He was barely 6'1". And, you know, he went and had a 8-year NFL career just based off of incredible athleticism and power and speed and movement, right? He was an amazing run blocker. He got into trouble at times in the NFL as a pass protector because he's going against 6'6", 320-pound defensive linemen who can get their hands on him. And you know, he's got shorter arms. But a little digression there. But here's a digression that all of you should appreciate. I want to talk about a guy who's supporting this podcast and supporting a Longhorn Nation with his sage financial advice. That's David McClellan, a former national championship swimmer and a partner with Form Financial Management, a fiduciary registered investment advisor. If you're managing your own money, there's a good chance you're doing it suboptimally because you don't have the time or the knowledge to basically see after your wealth. And that is why David comes into the picture. You can reach him at 312-933-8823, or you can just go down to the notes in the show and reach out to him via email or his phone. Retirement planning is David's specialty. So if you're within 10 years of retirement, he can help you understand when you can retire with confidence. You've saved a lot in your 401ks or your other tax-deferred accounts. You've done everything you're supposed to do dutifully. You're in for a rude awakening when you retire because you've got a tax bomb. And there are ways to defuse that tax bomb, and they are much more subtle than backdoor mega IRA, not a Roth IRA and all that kind of stuff. You can read, you know, doing Google searches. A little more subtle and a little more sophisticated than that, a little more nuance. Give David a call. Let him kick the tires on your financial soundness. You can reach him at 312-933-8823. He'll give you a free consult. You guys figure out if there's an opportunity for you to work together. Ian, does that sound good?
Yeah.
Are you concerned about your $30 million IRA becoming a tax bomb?
A little bit.
All right. You should be. All right. That's the right answer. All right. Speaking of bombs, is Texas going to go deep with Malik Murphy? He seems to have a propensity for it. Are we going to take some shots?
I mean, it's Sark, right?
It is like Sark.
Sark will dial up some shots for him, no doubt.
Is Sark contractually obligated to take 4 shots?
I think he's contractually obligated not to, right?
No. Yeah, I'm actually really curious.
What you were trying to set up, I couldn't.
It's all good. No. I'm actually really curious because I think, look, the obvious analysis on this is Texas runs the ball. They take care of the ball, play defense. We try to score on special teams, blah, blah, blah. Malik Murphy, we have a careful game plan with him. He attempts 16 passes, right?
Yeah.
I don't think it's crazy or improbable to think that one of the ways to protect Malik Murphy is to have him come out on a script, throwing the ball on the clear, easy reads that he does do well, mix it in with the run game, and you kind of do a low variance, safe passing game that highlights his abilities and highlights, frankly, the deficits that BYU has in athleticism on their back end against our receivers. And Malik Murphy throws 30 passes on the game, completes 21 for 208 yards. Is that a possibility too?
Yeah. And they have a lot of ways to do it, to your point. Like, yep, they can run RPOs with Whittington. They can do one of those games where they scheme up 10 to 15 targets for JT Sanders if he's feeling up for it. And those are just usually him and Helm. When they dust those guys off and take them out of the garage for a drive, they just routinely get open, especially both of them. Sanders, because he's so good, and Helm, because they just don't have the bandwidth to give him a lot of attention with all the other threats.
He's the forgotten man.
Yeah. And he catches the ball when you throw it at him. So he's valuable in that way. So, I mean, I think that would be the way to do it. Sark is generally, he's pretty good about trying to get his quarterbacks comfortable and trying to set him up for easy wins.
From a mental standpoint, we saw the adrenaline surging through Malik Murphy when he came in the game, threw a couple of rocket balls.
Yeah.
What do you think is the easiest way to break him in early and just sort of get, not, I mean, I'm talking about like coverage schemes, throws. I'm talking about the emotional, adrenalized aspect of, I've got this howitzer, I want to show it off. I'm excited. I'm in front of the 102,000 people. This is my shot. What do you do to calm that guy down out of the gate?
I would probably formation some maybe predetermined RPOs and maybe a tight end screen or two, like we've been mentioned, like we're kind of hinting at, and just force him to throw the quick, easy throws and see if they can get some rhythm. And then maybe in the second quarter is when I like take the reins off and just let him chuck it down the field.
I'm anticipating his first 8-yard throw to be, he breaks like JT Sanders' fingers like, and knocks the wind out of him as the ball hits him in the sternum. I think he's pretty fired up.
What are the odds of, do you think, of Arch Manning getting an early series just mixed in there, regardless of how
doing? Unlikely.
You think so?
Yeah, I think it's unlikely.
Why?
I think Sark's a big confidence guy. He wants the quarterback to feel like he's the quarterback. And, when Quinn Ewers struggled several times last year, did we bring Hudson Carr to, off the bench immediately?
No, but Hudson Card didn't have a rumored mega massive NIL deal either.
So I don't know. I mean, I guess my thought is, so when you say that, what does that say about the Mannings? I mean, they don't care. They're fine with Arch redshirting. Like, they don't have this sped up developmental timeline that everyone else wants or is trying to impose or like project on them. That's not how they think or operate.
Sure. But, like, how about this? Let's say you're Sark you're not totally sure if Malik can get you to the Big 12 championship. You think maybe Arch is a better bet, but Malik is ahead in the seniority and in the pecking order.
Yep.
But Arch hasn't been able to get into a game yet. So do you want to just like get him into a game to get his feet wet in case? I mean, Malik, another thing with Malik is that even if he goes out and he just dominates BYU, he's had injuries the last few years that have had him up and off the practice field, like his foot and whatever. And then without even playing.
Back spasms.
So maybe you want to get Arch's feet wet and you're like, hey, Malik, don't worry about it. This is just trying to get him acclimated a little bit just in case.
Yeah. So, I mean, the way you would do it, would I do it? Yeah. I don't know if Sark will, but and the way you would do it is say Wednesday, you call them both in. Malik, Arch is going in on the third series.
Yeah.
Come hell or high water.
Yeah.
And in the second half, he's going to come in on the third series. By the way, the first half's written in stone. Everything else we're playing by ear. You guys cool with that? And they'll both go, sure. Because then they know where they stand. And then Malik doesn't feel like, I got pulled, man. This is BS, right? It's like, oh, okay. I knew he was coming in on the third series. Yeah, that's how I do it. I don't think Sark's going to do that.
I don't think Sark's going to do that.
What do you think? You think he's going to do it?
I don't know. I think it would make sense if he did.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be mad.
But I don't know. I don't know. I don't know exactly. You know, there's so many complications. This was like a worst case scenario for Texas. It's like the best case scenario is Quinn has an awesome year. He goes to the NFL. He gets a really nice draft grade. And you're like, look, we just sent a guy to the first round or the top 10 or whatever. And now we have an honest battle between Quinn and Arch, and we announce the winner on our own timeline.
Malik and Arch, yeah.
What did I say?
You said Quinn and Arch.
Yeah, between Malik and Arch. And then, like, you have an outside chance of hanging on to the loser of the battle for the season, the following season. Now we're in this situation where Quinn obviously would probably prefer to come back, do really well in some postseason games if he's healthy and up for it, and then go to the NFL. If he doesn't play again this season, I don't know that his draft stock is where they want it to be.
Agreed.
And if he,
even if he does play, I'm not sure his draft stock will be where his camp thinks it is.
If he goes out and he whips Michigan because they don't have Texas signs.
We've already been scouted by Michigan when we beat Alabama. Yeah, they had some dudes sitting front and center in the Wyoming game, stealing signs right and left.
Or they'll just call Brent.
We'll just call Venables. Venables like, I stole their signs six months ago, man.
Got it. Don't worry. Yeah, here you go.
When they hold up the Humpty Dumpty card, that means screen. Yeah, I think. Yeah, I don't want to get on a Quinn Ewers tangent. I just would say that the NFL doesn't care about your South Lake Carroll high school tape.
They're definitely going to have some questions for him.
I think there's questions. I also think there's physical realities. I mean, I brought it up to you, I think, offline, but losing weight and getting in shape was great. Doing it while not lifting weights or just sort of lifting light or toning, as your wife likes to say, right?
She doesn't buy into that nonsense.
Okay. All right. Well,
all women should know that if you're a woman and you lift heavy, that's not a bad idea.
And you're not going to get big.
You're not going to get jacked because your physiology doesn't want to do that.
Well, I think they look at women bodybuilders on lots of steroids and supplements, and they assume that that's the result, right. But that's not the result. And by the way, those women are doing high reps. But yeah, I think weighing in the 190s, injury history, and frankly, in the NFL, you got to be pretty strong in the pocket. I don't just mean physically strong, but you need to not drop your eye level, not be bothered by being brushed against by a guy, even if he's still sort of blocked, right?
Yeah.
Those are important traits for a winning NFL quarterback if you're not Lamar Jackson. So I'll just say that we'll cross that bridge when we come to it in the off season. But I have some very specific thoughts on Quinn Ewers, and I won't pretend to know the mindset of every GM in the NFL, but there's a clear trend of physicality in the NFL for quarterbacks, and it's not hard to see which direction it's going.
Yeah.
Drake May, Caleb Williams, Justin Herbert, Josh Allen, Patrick Mahomes, they all look a certain way. And they don't wilt in the pocket.
Do you wonder if, so I used to call, I'm going to force you to talk about this longer than you want to.
I used to call
Shane Buechel a football player trapped in a baseball player's body.
Yeah.
And I kind of wonder if there's a sort of a similar thing with Quinn, like with his natural pop in his arm and his amazing, just like he can make that ball do anything he wants it to do. It's not just that he can rifle it down the field. He can do touch or whatever. It's just easy to imagine how he could have been like a power pitcher with a dominant 12-6 curve. But because he grew up in South Lake Carroll, it was always just going to be football.
Yeah, I mean, 100%. Or, you know, a shortstop or a second baseman with just a killer arm, right? And angles and all that stuff.
Yeah.
I think that's great. I think that's an apt description. Look, you know, Harlem is full of potential NFL defensive backs.
Yeah.
But they play basketball.
Yeah.
Because that's the culture. So, you know, we all know that there's a certain cultural overlay for football. And then there's also a genetic and physical reality. But if you don't have the overlay of the culture, your genetics and all that stuff doesn't matter. So, you know, if Jamaica, if the number one sport in Jamaica was cricket, and it is like the third sport in Jamaica, and not track and field, you wouldn't have them dominating. You wouldn't have an island nation dominating the 100 meters, right?
Yeah. I knew a guy that played offensive line for like a Division II Michigan directional school. And he was like, we had so many guys on our basketball team where I was like, you guys would be dominant if you played football.
Yeah.
But they play basketball.
Yeah. I mean, if you read any David Epstein, who is sort of the rational counterpoint to the overrated Malcolm Gladwell school, what he points out is beyond the fallacy of the 10,000 hours nonsense. What he points out is this: the repurposing of athletes from broader pools into narrower pools, and how those broad pool athletes without 10,000 hours, like literally 40 hours of training, can go and utterly dominate those fields, right? So the great—
What is it with you in the Walter Cronkite era where you're just desperate to be living in the 60s again, Paul?
What are you talking about?
No, okay, that didn't land.
What does that mean?
Malcolm Gladwell lost this.
The monk debate. I don't even want to get into it. It's the most embarrassing thing I've ever seen from a grown man. But it is a great— I was pleased because it's a great debunking of Gladwell. We're not getting into that. But the point is, so for example, when London hosted the Summer Olympics, they went and approached basically a bunch of second and third rate athletes in track and field in different sports. And they said, hey, are you willing to try out sculling? Are you willing to try out fencing? Are you willing to try out these other sports that are narrower and have sort of a smaller following and smaller pool of athletes? And these people said, yeah, and they did. And a bunch of these people ended up winning gold medals or medaling for Britain. Similar thing happened with Australia. they approached a bunch of Australian athletes. They approached an Australian gymnast who was like irrelevant in the gymnastics world. And they said to her, hey, are you interested in trying, this is for the Winter Olympics, are you interested in trying out the acrobatic skiing? And she's like, I've never seen snow and I've never put skis on. And they said, no problem. We'll help you with that. So she trained for 7 months and she medaled. So it's kind of gives you a little example of athleticism and its fungibility. And you know, she didn't put in 10,000 hours, folks, just so you know.
I'll tell you what, though, if you've ever seen a group of people that are fencing enthusiasts.
Yep.
This isn't like super shocking.
Yeah. And you know what? It's a, like if you're trying to get your kid into an Ivy League school.
Right.
Don't have them play basketball and baseball and football. They've got real competition there. Have them take up sculling. Have them take up fencing. Doesn't mean they're not good sports. Doesn't mean they're, you know, not good athletes, or you won't get in shape doing them and all that stuff. It's just, it's a athletic level versus participation algorithm, yeah, formula. And it's pretty straightforward. So talk about a tangent, Ian. We nailed it. All right. Before we talk about Michigan football, and Ian is a secondary Michigan fan, basically? Is that a fair description?
Yeah, I guess.
Okay. Well, we're going to talk about the disgusting cheaters that you pull for in a second. Before I do that, I want to talk about a guy that's not a disgusting cheater, unless it benefits you. No, I'm just kidding. His name's Gabe Winslow. You can reach him at 832-557-1095. You've heard me extol his virtues before. Law degree, over 20 years in the industry. He's been on the title side. He's been, of course, on the mortgage side. He understands every aspect of this, and he's operating at a much higher level than the average mortgage guy. No offense intended, but truth stated. Give him a call, 832-557-1095. See if he can help you out. Ian, still folding laundry dutifully. I'm very impressed. What a wonderful house husband Ian is. Thank you for not falling into traditional gender roles.
Yeah. Let me say this about Michigan before we start.
All right.
I generally pull for Michigan. I always pull for Michigan against Ohio State. Generally pull for anyone against Ohio State.
Ditto.
But because of the Michigan culture, it was, I would like root for them to beat Ohio State. And I was ecstatic when they just pummeled them 2 years in a row. But when Ohio State would show up and just blow the doors off and embarrass them, I always thought that was kind of hilarious.
Because there is the Michigan man thing, right?
Thinks so highly of himself.
Yes.
They have such a moral and overall superiority deal. Kind of like Texas fans, but really,
yes,
on a different level, honestly.
On a different level, it's true.
Because it's the Yankee culture deal. And it's where it's just like it's just a different level.
It's a little insufferable.
Slightly toned down version of the, what are those twins in the Social Network? The Harvard twins.
The Winklevoss?
Yeah. It's like a slightly toned down Winklevoss culture, right?
Yeah.
And so just the fact that there is the school to the south that they just couldn't do anything with and would just embarrass them and make them face reality for 3 hours once a year after Thanksgiving was really funny and really just cosmically just. But I don't really like Ohio State, so I kind of delight in that rivalry in both directions.
Yeah, I dislike Ohio State intensely, particularly after experiencing their fan base. But
right.
All right, if you guys have been under a rock, the basic thing is this. Michigan had assistants to the assistant who were traveling around buying tickets in enemy stadiums, scouting them out, not just Big Ten opponents, but also potential playoff opponents. They did this in Tennessee at Neyland Stadium. They did this. They had it all planned out. and they basically videotaped their signals. And then they got a guy who was an Annapolis grad and a Michigan homer and kind of a weird guy if you read some of the stories. He decoded the signals, and then he would go stand on the sideline next to the defensive coordinator.
Let's be honest. He kind of sounds like a more driven version of one of us. You or I with more drive and less scruples and a little and much more intensity about like Texas being good.
I would say also a little bit of a braggart, because what's going to sink him is a bunch of text messages to friends bragging about what he's doing. Right. Also a moron. I would keep my mouth shut on that, because
you would have a blog. This is how I cheat. So I outsmarted Brent Venables this year.
Yeah, well, here's also how this genius, he was getting Venmo'd and made it public. So for those of you on Venmo, you can make your Venmo payments private or public. And most people make them public, which always makes me laugh, because occasionally you'll run across friends that have kind of an embarrassing Venmo payment, written on the subject line. But this idiot was like, Northwestern game cheating comp with a wink emoji and a cash emoji and $872. So yeah, this guy wasn't even smart enough to use the prepaid debit cards or anything to have, and he was buying tickets under his name. So good job, buddy. He also had the awesome name of, what is it, Connor Stallions?
Yeah,
that's amazing. So that's all going on, and now people are debating of, well, is it really that big of a help? Is it really that big of a deal? Coaches have been doing this for a long time. And as you mentioned, Brent Venables developed a reputation at Clemson, and I'm sure it's carried over to Oklahoma, of he had an incredible ability to steal opponent signals. And it was always portrayed as he did it on game day, organically in the moment. But the more this comes out, I think it's pretty clear that Mr. Venables and Clemson engaged in some of these operations potentially too. So what's going to be the shakeout of this? Are we just going to go to helmet radios to make this all sort of a moot point? And what's the appropriate punishment for Michigan?
I don't know what the appropriate punishment. I'm sort of sympathetic to the Astros fan, where it's like the Astros had their names drug through the mud for years. And it was like, well, they're cheaters and they're worthless, and everyone associated with that program is a disgrace to baseball. And they spat in the face of the baseball gods, and they did the things that we all agree that you don't do. And then it turns out that everyone else is doing the same freaking thing. Right.
It's very similar to Lance Armstrong in cycling.
Yeah.
The resentment is not that he did drugs. It's that he did them optimally. And he also paired them with a really good physical regimen. And sort of like he nailed the drug taking in ways that the other groups did not.
There's still stuff to come out about this. Like, who's behind it? Because the EPA itself is pretty toothless. But there's like a Michigan man with a vendetta against Harbaugh that's been connected to it. And I feel like it's only a matter of time before we find out that like Ryan Day or an Ohio State booster was prominently involved as well, because Ryan Day has been unable to beat them on the field.
Well, so just like pre-NIL or even post-NIL, recruiting cheating or tampering with the portal, coaches bitch about it. They don't ever name names because they know most of them live in glass houses. And I could promise you more than Michigan has built a substantial signals operation. So it's going to be interesting to see how this falls out. And, as far as the Astros comp, I get it. And the Astros sort of professionalized their cheating, right, in ways that other teams had not. But it's also kind of understood in baseball, if you're not cheating, you're not trying.
Yeah. You got to hit a The ball's going 100 miles an hour and you got to hit it, Paul.
Yeah, that's all bullshit, too. I mean, so people are like, well, if Michigan knows the play, that doesn't help you. You still got to make the play. And it's like, hey, man, if you know they're coming double A-gap blitz and you've got a quarterback draw called and you've got 18 seconds left on the clock once you see their signal, you can change that to a little slant. And suddenly your disastrous play could turn into a nice game. Right. And if that happens enough times over the course of a game, it is a substantial benefit to your team. Funny observation, Ian. The COVID year, the disastrous COVID year where Michigan went 2-4, when no one in the Big Ten was allowed to be in stadiums. Contrast that to 2021 to now, where they've been, you know, effectively dominant.
Apparently. He started getting involved in 2020, though. And he would come in and he would steal signs because he has texts, apparently, where he was bragging about stealing signs from TV.
Yeah, I think that's how it got started. Yeah.
And then they hired him. And it wasn't until maybe 2022 that he started his paying people to go to games on his behalf and film the sideline operation.
Well, and so also when you steal signs off TV, you're just getting snippets and pieces. And so what you'll be able to do is be like, oh, that combination means cover two. But if you don't have the other nine calls, it's sort of incomplete, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, I just think it's interesting. And you mentioned the toothlessness of the NCAA. I think if there's a punishment, it might come from the Big Ten. And the question is, do the other schools,
yes,
to what degree are they participants in this? And then to what degree do they want to see Michigan punished?
They will punish Michigan. They will punish Michigan at any cost.
Yeah, especially Ohio State.
Yeah.
And then I got to say, I want to know in the coaches' meetings and the rules committee meetings, I want to know the coaches that are voting against electronic signals. You know, they're voting against the quarterback radio helmet, which bypasses all of this.
Yeah.
And I can almost guarantee you Oklahoma and Brent Venables and Clemson with Dabo Swinney, when Venables was there, they were voting against the electronics.
Right.
So anybody, I think that would be an interesting record to examine.
Maybe Gary Patterson.
Oh, I guarantee you Gary Patterson. But the thing about Gary Patterson that's hilarious is if you watch TCU games, especially when he was really engaged, he's screaming adjustments till the snap of the ball. Yeah. And he's yelling out the opponent's play, right? I mean, so I think one thing most casual fans don't know is right before the ball snapped, a lot of coaches know what the play is. It's a question of, can you get the adjustment in? And if you can't actually, if you haven't created a whole process formally to get your adjustments in speedily, then you actually will probably be hurting your defense by screaming something at like the very last second. And they look over at you like, what? Or, huh? You know, inside run. And then so as linebackers, you both sprint at the snap of the ball and the back sees a big clump in the middle and busts it outside for 70, right? So I don't know. I think there's a systematization of this that if you don't do that correctly, which I think Michigan did, I think they systematized it pretty clearly, then it's actually not super helpful to have signals. But if you create a whole process where you can put in quick in-game adjustments to the signal stealing, I think it over the course of the game, I think you aggregate a pretty massive advantage.
I think this also all begs the question. I've been having this conversation with my subscribers on America's War Game of like, why do teams insist on signaling in plays? If you're so vulnerable to this, why do they do that? And my best answer is that signaling in plays allows the offensive coordinator to joystick the situation in his plays and the chalkboard as much as he can.
Yep.
And all these guys tend to be control freaks that are utterly terrified of a game where the 18 to 22 year olds in their charge have greater agency, right? To make sure that they make the right play and the right decision. And they want to try to control it tight-fisted as much as possible.
100%.
Gary Patterson's genius was in developing a defensive system that split the field up in the division of labor so much that he could recruit athletes and turn them into cogs in his system. Right?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it gives you some autonomy, right? And that's the ultimate autonomy. That's why I always say, if you want to play good defense, even though it seems counterproductive, focus less on having every call at your disposal and focus more on teaching every player their position. Because if they really understand their position, they actually have autonomy to act, what, you know, versus what they see in front of them.
Well, that's what Leach would do. But I think a lot of these guys would rather their players be automatons.
100%. Yeah, I think, well, then the funny thing about this all, Ian, is what do we call? It's an old vestige of what a quarterback used to be. We still call quarterbacks when we're writing because we don't want to use the same word over and over. What's a synonym for a quarterback?
Field general.
Field general or signal caller.
Yeah, signal caller.
Quarterbacks ain't calling no signals, and they ain't been calling no signals in a long time. But you know what? There was a time in the 70s and 60s that if an offensive coordinator tried to send in a play, a veteran quarterback would literally look over at the sideline and like shake his head, like, buzz off. This is my offense. Like, we talked about what we want to do in this game. I'm calling the plays. So that's changed.
Well, and that's what Leach always did.
100%.
And I feel like, I actually think that's the better way to do it. But if you're at like a Texas and you're recruiting five-star quarterbacks that want to play early,
yeah,
and you have five-star athletes everywhere that want to play early and you want to convince them that they can, then you end up with automaton system stuff.
Well, I love the Leach film sessions, of course, with the quarterbacks where he'd talk to them. And then there's another funny story of a tech receiver was asking him, like, what routes do you want me to run to beat that coverage? And Leach looked at him and like took the laser pointer and circled a big green patch. And he said, I want you to run there. And the receiver's like, yeah, yeah, yeah. He's not getting it. He's like, yeah, but like a curl? Or, and he's like, Leach is like, run to the open space and the quarterback will throw it to you. And the receiver's like, oh, okay. All right. Sounds good.
He had another great one in that athletic piece that accumulated all these stories of his, where one of his quarterbacks was like one of his first practices and he threw an interception. And Leach was like, you just threw it to the guy on the other team. That's the very last thing you want to do. And the guy's like, yeah, no kidding. Like, what should I have done though? He's like, you don't throw it to them. It's very simple.
Oh man, I miss that guy. He was awesome for college football. Do you think Leach, no, not just even Leach himself, but Leachian ideas and tactics could work at a five-star recruiting university?
No.
Why?
There's just too much ego and drama and no. Like, you'd have to... You need, like, really special guys. It's like, yeah. One of my favorite sports analogies these days, the Warriors, they have such a free-flowing style, right? And so much of it hinges on the fact that they have, like, this core of three uber-smart, selfless players. Particularly Steph, but also Draymond. Where it's like the things that they do and that they get away with, where it's very free flowing and the ball doesn't stop moving and people are selfless. It just doesn't work without the right kinds of characters. And like five stars are rarely the right kind of guy to do that with, right? Because they've just been told how great they are and how they need to protect their gift and their brand throughout college. And so they just can't live by that Bob Myers, like, it's amazing what you can do when no one cares about who gets the credit kind of mantra.
It's true. Well, I'll tell you what, speaking of gift, Ian's writing is a gift for those of you who are interested in football and beyond just Texas football. You'll find Ian on Inside Texas, where he does a great job. But also, you could find him on the America's War Game Substack. Is that right, Ian?
That's right.
All right, y'all go check it out and become a follower. I think you'll find it enjoyable, and I think it'll help grow your game and understanding of the game. Ian, anything we want to add before we're out of here?
I've been using your call matching in Battleship. I've attributed it to you, but
all right, thank you.
I've been using that a lot because it's just so useful for, like, especially with talking about Alex Grinch.
Well, I tell you what, Ian, we're seeing more of it in college football and sports in general, and not less of it, which is unfortunate.
It's amazing.
It is amazing. Ultimately, you cannot turn players or any individual into a robot. You've got to give them some ability to choose and have autonomy, or you actually degrade their ability to play the sport that they're really good at. And a lot of coaches are slow to that realization.
It's just, there's so much ego and so much money at stake. It's hard to give up control.
It is. It's, well, you have to be a true teacher to give up control, because you give the pupil autonomy to follow your teachings broadly, rather than a narrow, you run to this spot. I don't care what you saw. I don't care what you think. I don't put you out there to think. That's very common football nomenclature. I might have heard that as a player once or twice myself. So for Ian Boyd, I am Paul Wadlington saying, hook 'em.
Interest rates are up and the market is tumultuous. And now more than ever, you need the best darn possible mortgage broker working on your behalf. That's Gabe Winslow, and you can reach him at 832-557-1095, or you can go to mortgagesbygabe.com. What makes Gabe so unique? Well, he's incredibly bright. He's a UT grad. He's got a law degree. He's been in the mortgage industry for over 20 years, and he is a true mortgage broker. What does that mean? It means he can shop for the best deal at over 80 different lenders and find you the terms that best suit you. Most mortgage guys you talk to won't reveal that they have exactly one size fits all for you and exactly one conduit to get your loan. If you are in these hyper-competitive markets and you're in these markets that have frankly gotten a lot less friendly to the consumer, you need the best possible person working on your behalf. That's Gabe Winslow. He has our full endorsement. You can reach him at 832-557-1095.
Are you worried that recent events have derailed your retirement plans? It certainly made us reassess all aspects of ours, and that's why we're proud to offer our listeners a chance to work with David McClellan, a fiduciary financial advisor from Forum Financial. David's practice specializes in financial life coaching and retirement planning, and right now he's offering free consultations for our listeners if you mention the podcast. As part of this consultation, David can help you understand your financial freedom number and what that means to you in assessing your future financial plans. If you want to build wealth, if you want to make optimal decisions within your financial life, David is someone you need to talk to. You can reach him at 312-933-8823. Once again, that's David McClellan at 312-933-8823. He's located in Austin, Texas, but he's got a nationwide clientele. Do yourself a favor and get some great financial advice for free and see if you might want to work with Mr. McClellan. I think you'll be happy with your phone call. Do you need a realtor in Central Texas? Of course you do. We all need a realtor in Central Texas, even those of us who live in Dallas or Houston or San Francisco or Denver, Colorado. You need to go to Central Texas anyway. And the reason is Laura Baker is a fantastic realtor. She's great at what she does. She's a member of the elite Andy Allen team for Keller Williams. You can reach her at 512-784-0505. Talk with Laura if you're thinking about putting your house on the market. This is a great time to get market comps. If you're looking to buy in the market, you need all the help you can get. call Laura, and it's 512-784-0505.